life principles. Philosophically, Lovecraft was a dyed-in-the-wool scientific materialist. Nevertheless, he is a felicitous example of someone who knew ravishments that in another context would qualify as spiritual or religious. Yet, from childhood, he adhered to a vigorous atheism. In his lectures collected as The Varieties of Religious Experience, William James proposes that a sense of ontological wonder and cosmic emotion argues for the legitimacy of religious faith. In both his creative writings and his letters, Lovecraft's expression of the feelings James describes form an exception to the philosopher-psychologist's argument. For Lovecraft, cosmic wonder and a tranquility tinged with terror, as the British political theorist and aesthetician Edmund Burke referred to such experiences, were basic to his interest in remaining alive. Sublimating his awareness of the universe as nothingness in motion, he also mitigated the boredom that plagued his life by distracting himself with reveries of surprise, discovery, strangeness, and the impingement of the cosmic, lawless, and mystical upon the prosaic sphere of the known. From the other side of an emotional and spiritual chasm, the French scientist and Christian philosopher Blaise Pascal wrote of his sense of being engulfed in the infinite immensity of spaces whereof I know nothing, and which know nothing of me. I am terrified. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces fills me with dread. Pascal's is not an unnatural reaction for those phobic to infinite spaces that know nothing of them. Kinophobia is the fear of such vast spaces and voids. Perhaps kinophilia should be coined to describe the ontological wonder and cosmic emotion Lovecraft felt when he contemplated the outer rim of the unknown. A complex and contradictory figure, as illustrated, Lovecraft often seemed to be on the fence when it came to his convictions about the value of existence. In a letter to Edwin Baird, the first editor of Weird Tales, he penned some remarks that express a univocal stand by a pessimist who is estranged from all solace known to ordinary folk. These merit quotation at length. Popular authors do not, and apparently cannot, appreciate the fact that true art is obtainable only by rejecting normality and conventionality in toto, and approaching a theme purged utterly of any usual or preconceived point of view. Wild and different as they may consider their quasi-weird products, it remains a fact that the bizarrery is on the surface alone, and that basically they reiterate the same old conventional values and motives and perspectives. Good and evil, teleological illusion, sugary sentiment, anthropocentric psychology, the usual superficial stock in trade, and all shot through with the eternal and inescapable commonplace. Whoever wrote a story from the point of view that man is a blemish on the cosmos, who ought to be eradicated? As an example, a young man I know lately told me that he means to write a story about a scientist who wishes to dominate the earth, and who, to accomplish his ends, trains and overdevelops germs, and leads armies of them in the manner of the Egyptian plagues. I told him that, although this theme has promise, it is made utterly commonplace by assigning the scientist a normal motive. There is nothing outré about wanting to conquer the earth. Alexander, Napoleon, and Wilhelm II wanted to do that. Instead, I told my friend, he should conceive a man with a morbid, frantic, shuddering hatred of the life principle itself, who wishes to extirpate from the planet every trace of biological organism, animal, and vegetable alike, including himself. That would be tolerably original. But, after all, originality lies with the author. One can't write a weird story of real power without perfect psychological detachment from the human scene, and a magic prism of imagination which suffuses theme and style alike with that grotesquerie and disquieting distortion characteristic of morbid vision. Only a cynic can create horror, for behind every masterpiece of the sort must reside a driving, demonic force that despises the human race and its illusions, and longs to pull them to pieces and mock them. The salient interest of this letter is that it shows Lovecraft as a perfectionist of cosmic disillusion. But, relatively dissociated from Lovecraft the cosmic disillusionist, was another Lovecraft, one who reveled in protectionist illusions that could not be more alien to the propensities of his alter ego. In this latter identity, he took refuge from what he specified as his cynicism, also cosmic pessimism, in a world of distractions and anchorings he had amassed over the years. Among them was his sentimental immersion in the past. Especially dear to him was the traditional way of life emblemized by architectural remnants of 17th and 18th century New England. Old towns with winding streets, houses with semicircular fan-like doors, and other postcard images of Yankeedom conjured up for Lovecraft a picture of bygone times as an aesthetic phenomenon that often tailed into a blood-and-soil mysticism. A proud Novanglian, Lovecraft grew up and lived among abundant reminders of a past he idealized. His attachment to historic New England counterbalanced his infatuation with the far reaches of time and space, beside which, as he well knew, the outdated culture streams that so enraptured him were local, fleeting, and accidental forms without immanent virtue. For Lovecraft, both quaint, small-paned windows and a bracing alienage from human mores had charms that he heartily honored in his works as well as his life, even during his darkest days of cynicism and pessimism. Like most of us, Lovecraft distracted himself with fabricated values, and he did so until death was bestowed upon him by a combination of intestinal cancer and Bright's disease. Concerned as a fiction writer with smashing to bits humanity's grand illusion about its place in the universe, Lovecraft welcomed any illusions he could accept in good faith, as did Zapffe and Schopenhauer, who also pursued gratifying diversions that took their minds off what the latter philosopher called the vanity and suffering of life. During his later years, Lovecraft did seem to mellow considerably as he walked the plank into non-existence. In letters to his friends and colleagues, he attested that he had left his cynicism and pessimism behind and had become an indifferentist, meaning one who sees no malice in the physical universe, but only a flux of particles. To the benefit of supernatural horror aficionados, Lovecraft's indifferentist philosophy did not require him to discontinue writing about virulent phenomena that compromise the sanity of anyone who learns of their existence. Lovecraft was exhilarated by the idea of something pernicious that made a nightmare of our world, whether it was indifferent to us or quite partial to our devastation. In his indifferentism, Lovecraft did not seem to have shambled far from the cognitive style of the individual who advised his friend to write about a man with a morbid, frantic, shuddering hatred of the life principle itself, who wishes to extirpate from the planet every trace of biological organism, animal and vegetable alike, including himself. If only there were a man who could bring to fruition such a wish. Then the earth could finally be cleared off, as Wilbur Whately wrote in his diary in The Dunwich Horror. Why anyone should be drawn to the writings of Lovecraft and his confederates is usually expounded as a natural aspect of the human temper, a healthy yearning of our souls to exceed the bounds of ordinary existence. In his lecture On Morbidity, part of a series of brief expositions on supernatural horror, an academician known only as Professor Nobody, an ostentatiously cocky pseudonym, submits his analysis of an atypical individual who does not partake in the wholesome motivation of the majority with respect to the horrific and extraordinary, a man with a morbid, frantic, shuddering hatred of the life principle itself. While there is indeed something invigorating in supernatural horror for this individual, it is a negative rather than a positive activation that pleasures him by its antipathy to all that lives. The floor is now ceded to the professor. Isolation, mental strain, emotional exertions, visionary infatuations, well-executed fevers, repudiations of well-being, only a few of the many exercises practiced by that specimen we shall call the morbid man. And our subject of supernatural horror is a vital part of his program, retreating from a world of health and sanity, or at least one that daily invests in such commodities. The morbid man seeks the shadows behind the scenes of life. He backs himself into a corner alive with cool draughts and fragrant with centuries of must. It is in that corner that he builds a world of ruins out of the battered stones of his imagination, a rancid world rife with things smelling of the crypt. But this world is not all a romantic sanctum for the dark in spirit. So let us condemn it for a moment, this deep end of dejection, although there is no name for what might be called the morbid man's sin, it still seems in violation of some deeply ingrained morality. The morbid man does not appear to be doing himself or others any good. And while we all know that melancholic moping and lugubrious ruminating are quite palatable as side dishes of existence, he has turned them into a house specialty. Ultimately, however, he may meet this charge of wrongdoing with a simple, "What of it?" Now, such a response assumes morbidity to be a certain class of vice, one to be pursued without apology, and one whose advantages and disadvantages must be enjoyed or endured outside the law. But, as a sower of vice, if only in his own soul, the morbid man incurs the following censure: that he is a symptom or a cause of decay within both individual and collective spheres of being. And decay, like every other process of becoming, hurts everybody. "Good," shouts the morbid man. "Not good," counters the crowd. Both positions betray dubious origins, one in resentment, the other in fear. And when the moral debate on this issue eventually reaches an impasse or becomes too tangled for truth, then psychological polemics can begin. Later on, we will find other angles from which this problem may be attacked, enough to keep us occupied for the rest of our lives. Meanwhile, the morbid man keeps putting his time on earth to no good use, until in the end, amidst mad winds, wan moonlight, and pasty specters, he uses his exactly like everyone else uses theirs. All up. Undoing 3. When people are asked to respond to the statement, "I am happy, true or false," the word "true" is spoken more often than false, overwhelmingly so. If there is some loss of face in confessing that one is not happy, this does not mean that those who profess happiness as their dominant humor are lying through their teeth. People want to be happy. They believe they should be happy. And if some philosopher says they can never be happy because their consciousness has ensured their unhappiness, that philosopher will not be part of the dialogue, especially if he blathers about discontinuing our species by ceasing to bear children who can also never be happy, even though, to extend the point, they can also never be unhappy given their inexperience of existing. Ask Zapfe. So, you ask whether I would choose to be unborn. One must be born in order to choose, and the choice involves destruction. But ask my brother in that chair over there. Indeed, it is an empty one. My brother did not get so far. Yet ask him, as he is traveling like the wind below the sky, crashing against the beach, scenting in the grass, reveling in his strength as he pursues his living food. Do you think he is bereaved by his incapacity to fulfill his fate on the waiting list of the Oslo Housing and Savings Society? And have you ever missed him? Look around in a crowded afternoon tram and reflect whether you would allow a lottery to select one of the exhausted toilers as the one whom you put into this world. They pay no attention as one person gets off and two get on. The tram keeps rolling along. The point that in the absence of birth nobody exists who can be deprived of happiness is terribly conspicuous. For optimists, this fact plays no part in their existential computations. For pessimists, however, it is axiomatic. Whether a pessimist urges us to live heroically with a knife in our gut or denounces life as not worth living is immaterial. What matters is that he makes no bones about hurt being the great problem it is incumbent on philosophy to observe. But this problem can be solved only by establishing an imbalance between hurt and happiness that would enable us in principle to say which is more desirable, existence or non-existence. While no airtight case has ever been made regarding the undesirability of human life, pessimists still run themselves ragged trying to make one. Optimists have no comparable mission. When they do argue for the desirability of human life, it is only in reaction to pessimists arguing the opposite, even though no airtight case has ever been made regarding that desirability. Optimism has always been an undeclared policy of human culture, one that grew out of our animal instincts to survive and reproduce, rather than an articulated body of thought. It is the default condition of our blood, and cannot be effectively questioned by our minds or put in grave doubt by our pains. This would explain why, at any given time, there are more cannibals than philosophical pessimists. For optimists, human life never needs justification, no matter how much hurt piles up, because they can always tell themselves that things will get better. For pessimists, there is no amount of happiness, should such a thing as happiness even obtain for human beings except as a misconception, that can compensate us for life's hurt. As a worst-case example, a pessimist might refer to the hurt caused by some natural or human-made cataclysm. To adduce a hedonic counterpart to the horrors that attach to such cataclysms would require a degree of ingenuity from an optimist, but it could be done. And the reason it could be done, the reason for the eternal stalemate between optimists and pessimists, is that no possible formula can be established to measure proportions and types of hurt and happiness in the world. If such a formula could be established, on the premise that an oppositional comparison may be made between hurt and happiness, of course, then either pessimists or optimists would have to give in to their adversaries. One formula to establish the imbalance at issue has been tendered by the South African philosopher of ethics David Benatar. In his Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence, Benatar attempts to prove that, because some amount of suffering is inevitable for all who are born, while the absence of happiness does not deprive those who would have been born but were not, the scales are tipped in favor of not bearing children. Therefore, propagators violate any conceivable system of morality and ethics because they are guilty of doing harm. To Benatar, the extent of the harm that always occurs matters not. Once harm has been insured by the beginning of a bundle of joy, a line has been crossed from moral, ethical behavior to immoral, unethical behavior. This violation of morality and ethics holds for Benatar in all instances of childbirth. Nevertheless, people like Benatar, who argue that the world's ideal population size is zero, are written off as being unhealthy of mind. Further accentuating this presumed unhealthiness is Benatar's argument that giving birth is not only harmful, but should be seen as so egregiously harmful that there is no happiness that can counterbalance it. As harms go in this world, there are none worse than the harm that entails all others. Ask William James for a perspective on one of those great harms, to which he gives the name melancholy, and how it is generally passed over in the lives of healthy adults. The method of averting one's attention from evil and living simply in the light of good is splendid as long as it will work. It will work with many persons. It will work far more generally than most of us are ready to suppose, and within the sphere of its successful operation, there is nothing to be said against it as a religious solution. But it breaks down impotently as soon as melancholy comes, and even though one be quite free from melancholy oneself, There is no doubt that healthy-mindedness is inadequate as a philosophical doctrine, because the evil facts which it refuses positively to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may, after all, be the best key to life's significance, and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest levels of truth. The normal process of life contains moments as bad as any of those which insane melancholy is filled with, moments in which radical evil gets its innings and takes its solid turn. The lunatic's visions of horror are all drawn from the material of daily fact. Our civilization is founded on the shambles, and every individual existence goes out in a lonely spasm of helpless agony. If you protest, my friend, wait until you arrive there yourself. James himself suffered a brush with melancholy, but he made a full recovery and began to think positively, or at least equivocally, about being alive, answering yes to the question, is life worth living? However, by force of his honesty of intellect, he knew this opinion needed to be defended as much as any other opinion. No logic can support it. Indeed, logic defeats all feeling that life is worth living, which, James says, only a self-willed belief in a higher order of existence can instill. Then every suffering will seem worthwhile in the way that the vivisection of a living dog, to use James's example, would seem worthwhile to the animal if only it could comprehend the goodly ends its pain serves for the higher order of human existence. In his lecture, Is Life Worth Living?, James opined that human beings, unlike dogs, can in fact imagine a higher order of existence than theirs, one that may legitimate the worst adversities of mortal life. James was a rare philosopher in that he put no faith in logic, and he was doubtless wise to adopt that stance, since the fortunes of those who attempt to defend their opinions with logic are not enviable. Naturally, for those whose opinion is that it is better to be than better never to have been, Benatar's logic for the latter proposition is rejected as faulty, the more so in that its conclusions are not supported by a consensus of ordinary folk. Logic notwithstanding, Benatar's moral-ethical censure of reproduction does prove that humanity's continuance is not universally accepted as a good in itself, even in a super-modern world. It also reminds us that no one can make a case that every individual's birth, or any individual's birth, is a good in itself. And that is the case that needs to be made, at least morally and ethically speaking, as well as logically speaking. For more on this, see the section Pressurized in the chapter The Cult of Grinning Martyrs. If most people believe that being alive is all right, the alternative to this belief having no appeal for them, the rectitude of causing new people to become alive, is just a matter of opinion. Repression. In The Last Messiah, Zapfe wrote, "The whole of living that we see before our eyes today is from inmost to outmost enmeshed in repressional mechanisms, social and individual. They can be traced right into the tritest formulas of everyday life." The quartet of formulas that Zapfe picked out as individual and social mechanisms of repression are probably the most trite he could have chosen, which may have been deliberate on his part because they are so familiar to us and so visible in our day-to-day existence. These mechanisms are related to the psychoanalytic theory of unconscious repression, although they are also perilously accessible to the conscious mind. And when they are accessed, no one can concede them with impunity. Not overweight persons or tobacco users, who must play dumb when they are scarfing down a cupcake or smoking a cigarette. Not soldiers fighting a war, who must not be aware they are risking their lives and limbs for a rationalization, their country, their God, etc. Not anyone who is going to suffer and die, that is, everyone, who will not voluntarily confess to playing the same old games for as long as possible, rather than be haunted by thoughts of mortality and the unpleasantness that may precede it, and definitely not artists who keep their aesthetic distance for fear of being hamstrung by the realities they bring to life. Once the facts that repressional mechanisms hide are accessed, they must be excised from our memory, or new repressional mechanisms must replace the old, so that we may continue to be protected by our cocoon of lies. If this is not done, we will be whimpering misereres, morning, noon, and night, instead of chanting that day by day, in every way, we are getting better and better. Although we may sometimes admit to the guileful means we use to keep us doing what we do, this is only a higher level of self-deception and paradox, not evidence that we stand on the heights of some meta-reality where we are really real. We say we know what is in store for us in this life, and we do, but we do not know. We cannot, if we are to survive and multiply. Annotating humanity's attempt to bluff itself in the interest of the species is an extensive literature on self-deception, denial, and repression. Naturally, none of those working in this area of study believe human life to be such a morass of self-deception, denial, and repression that we do not know which way is up. But in Zapfe's analysis of self-deception, denial, and repression, we cannot know which way is up without paying dearly for this knowledge. Enough of us must addle our consciousness so that we can be far less conscious than we might, which is the tragedy of the human species for anyone who might have forgotten. Those who cannot pull off this jugglery will suffer the consequences. Some who study self-deception, denial, etc., believe these are healthy practices if they facilitate our happiness without infringing on the happiness of our fellows. They speak of self-deception, denial, etc. as useful fictions or positive illusions and ballyhoo them as staples for both the individual and society. For his book Vital Lies, Simple Truths, The Psychology of Self-Deception, Daniel Goleman studied how people and groups play along with factitious designs to scotch the animus and anxiety that would be loosed if an etiquette of honesty were somehow enforced. Others believe that self-deceptive practices are too complex to be usefully analyzed. This does not mean that self-deceptive practices do not support heinous acts by the ingenious denial of these acts. It only means that we cannot know how self-deception works in these cases. Finally, many of those who study self-deception believe we are not capable of self-deception because we cannot both consciously know something and consciously not know it, for this would involve us in a paradox. However, others have reasoned their way around this supposed paradox. An example of such reasoning is presented by Kent Bock, who offers three means of avoiding unwanted thoughts that are nevertheless accessible to a subject's consciousness: rationalization, evasion, and jamming. These are identical to the methods of isolation, anchoring, and distraction spotted by Zapfe in human life. Each may keep a subject in a state of self-deception regarding what is really the case. Bach's essay does not, of course, extend his three categories of self-deception to the entire human species, as does Zapfe. To Zapfe, we remember, we are all by nature and necessity false and paradoxical beings, and should terminate our existence as strangers to reality, who cannot live as we are and cannot live otherwise, who must constrain our consciousness because, tragically, our sanity depends on it. In his Why We Lie, The Evolution of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, David Livingstone Smith examines the mechanisms of self-deception and denial, both individual and social, in terms of evolutionary psychology. This approach leads him to a conclusion about these mechanisms that is compatible with Zapfe's diagnosis of humanity as a paradox. Smith's thesis is that at some time in the remote past, the human mind split into the dual levels of conscious and unconscious processes, the better to deceive itself and others for the purpose of adaptation. This makes Smith's hypothesis about the process of denial tantamount to that of the psychoanalytic theory of repression, by which individuals deny unpalatable facts about themselves to themselves, and by extension to others. Smith is, in fact, a psychoanalyst, and this may be seen in his statement that the ever-present possibility of deceit is a crucial dimension of every human relationship, even the most central, our relationship with our very selves. To practice this deceit, one must repress consciousness of the deceiving, which does not exclude self-deception concerning consciousness itself and what it discloses about human life. Effectively, then, Smith is allied with Zapfe's position that the human being performs a more or less self-conscious repression, Zapfe's emphasis, of its damning surplus of consciousness. The process is virtually constant during our waking and active hours, and is a requirement of social adaptability and of everything commonly referred to as healthy and normal living. Psychiatry even works on the assumption that the healthy and viable is at one with the highest in personal terms. Depression, fear of life, refusal of nourishment, and so on, are invariably taken as signs of a pathological state and treated thereafter. Often, however, such phenomena are messages from a deeper, more immediate sense of life, bitter fruits of a geniality of thought or feeling at the root of anti-biological tendencies. It is not the soul being sick, but its protection failing, or else being rejected because it is experienced, correctly, as a betrayal of ego's highest potential.